So we have some great shows here on WRCT that might interest you. Check out the Eli Show. After those crazy Saturday nights, sleep in and wake up on Sunday to the Eli Show on WRCT for top-tier interviews, awesome music, and good vibes only. The Eli Show is what cool people listen to on Sundays at 12 p.m. on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh and online at WRCT.org. And don't forget Audible Sounds. Looking to expand your horizons, in the mood for something challenging, obscure, weird? Tune in to Audible Sounds for all the latest experimental music from around the world and discover the strangest genre you didn't know you loved. Okay, so what did we just hear? We heard the newest from Wilco, that's Evicted. Before that, Sweeping Promises with Eraser. Before that, Little Dragon, Frisco. La Security with Suspens. Portugal the Man with Dummy. Ivy, which is the 25th anniversary of Apartment Life. That was the best thing. Night Beats with Hot Gee. And we started off that very long set with Jolie Holland and Haunted Mountain. So I hope you enjoyed the show this week. I'll be playing more new music for you next week. Stay tuned for Quartz in Session, and have a great week, everyone. Bye.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for. Harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet. Or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community, at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've tuned in to Pandemonium, a public affairs anthology from WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. And now, Pandemonium.
Hi there. I'm Mando Richard from WRCT Pittsburgh, and what we're going to hear is an interview I recorded on June 23rd of 2022 and aired on WRCT's Whiskey Before Breakfast on July 27th of 2022 with guitarist John Shane, talking about one of his projects in which he took a lot of the music of legendary Memphis blues man W.C. Handy and converted it over to the guitar. So what comes next is an air check of the broadcast of that interview. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for tuning in to WRCT Pittsburgh. So up next, you're going to hear a conversation with guitarist and entertainer John Shane. And he's going to talk about the CD he put out in 2017 called Getting Handy with the Blues and the book he's just put out, in which he details how he managed to move these W.C. Handy tunes to the guitar. And we're going to start the interview off by hearing John Shane play on the guitar perhaps W.C. Handy's most famous song, the St. Louis Blues.
I'll pack my trunk and make rings. She pulls men around by her apron strings. And if it weren't for powder and for store-bought hair, all the men around wouldn't go nowhere, nowhere. I got the St. Louis blues, just as blue as I can be. That gal got a heart like a broadcast in the sea, or else she wouldn't have gone so far from me. Like a schoolboy loves his pie. I love my baby till the day I die. St. Louis woman with her diamond ring. She pulled men around by her apron strings. And if it weren't for powder for store-bought hair, all the men around, they wouldn't go nowhere, nowhere. Got the St. Louis blues, just as blue as I can be. That gal got a heart like a rock cast in the sea, or else she wouldn't have gone so far from me. I love that gal like a schoolboy loved his pie. I love that gal like a schoolboy loved his pie. I love my baby till the day I die.
You just heard guitarist John Shane play W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues from his record Getting Handy with the Blues, a musical tribute to W.C. Handy. And I've caught up with John here in bucolic Millwood, Virginia. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So when did you put out this record, Getting Handy with the Blues, a tribute to the legacy of W.C. Handy?
This album came out in 2017, I believe. I was doing a project for an arts council down in New Bern, North Carolina, where they were doing a series of concerts of American composers. And Steve Kelly down there asked me if I would do a whole evening of W.C. Handy music. And I said to him, "You realize W.C. Handy did not play the guitar, right?" He said, "Of course, I know that, but I think you could do it. It'll be a nice challenge." And I put him off for about 18 months, and finally I did it because I knew it would be months of work. And I learned a whole set of material, all from the 19-teens and 20s. And then after I learned it, I thought, well, I should record this stuff. And I made an album, and it's called Getting Handy with the Blues. And I didn't really think much of it until they started playing it on the big satellite radio station.
Wow, so you started getting airplay with this.
I did.
And not just familiar tunes that everybody knows, like St. Louis Blues, but you're doing lots of different things.
Yeah, there's about half of the music is written by W.C. Handy, and the other half are acts that were associated with him that he produced and published on his own labels and companies. A lot of these songs that are on the record were originally done either on piano or as a jazz orchestra, like a ragtime orchestra, as Handy played the cornet as his main instrument. But a lot of them were also female vocals. So you have Ethel Waters and Bessie Smith and Mamie Smith, some of the greatest jazz and blues vocalists of their day played this material.
You even got one song on here that was written by, or co-written by, his daughter, Lucille.
Yes, this is the Deep River Blues, not to be confused with Doc Watson's version. And it's a really interesting composition. Should we give that a listen?
Sure. Does somebody sing it with you?
No, I do all the vocals.
Oh, my God. John Shane is going to prove why he should always hire a female vocalist as you listen to him play and sing.
It's actually sung from a man's perspective. So.
Well, John says he's justified in singing the Deep River Blues, right?
Justified.
Here we go. The Deep River Blues by John Shane from his record that's about 5 years old now called Getting Handy with the Blues.
Breaking as I watch the evening tide, because I'm over here, my gal is on the other side. Deep river, when I feel worried, I come to you. I come and sit beside you when I'm feeling blue. You're the only one I can tell my troubles to. If I had the means, I'd go to New Orleans, but right at this time I ain't got a dime to spare. At the break of day, you'll find me gone away. There's no one to care or want to know where I'm gone. If I get the blues, I'll take off my shoes, I'll look to the Lord and jump overboard and drown.
We're sitting out here in Millwood, Virginia, where I'm one of the campers and John Shane is one of the teachers, and we're talking about his music of W.C. Handy as performed on the guitar. And the folks just heard him playing and singing Deep River Blues, co-written by Eddie Green and Lucille Handy. Did her dad publish the tune?
Yes, yes. This one, I think, came out in the 1920s, 24, something like that. And Handy at that point was already probably close to 50 years old. So his adult daughter would have probably been in her 30s at that point when she recorded it. Interestingly, he still has a grandson, Carlos Handy, who, I mean, this W.C.
Still today, in 2022.
Yes, and he's alive. And yes, W.C. Handy was born in the 1870s. And Carlos Handy is not a young man, but he is running the Handy Foundation, which raises money for children's education programs. And I'm happy to say we put one of these albums in his hands, and he's heard it, too. So,
what's really difficult about getting this music that was originally written for a jazz orchestra or for piano, what's really difficult about getting it onto the guitar fretboard?
Yeah, the... many of the songs, if they were written for the jazz orchestra or potentially for piano or for somebody's voice, they get keyed into keys like B flat, A flat, E flat. And these are not super guitar keys, no. Really not super for any of the stringed instruments. So a lot of times what I would do is I would listen to it in the original key, right? And then I would have to figure out how I was going to play that, because I'm doing the bass in the thumb and I'm doing the melody in the fingers. And then I would have to learn it, usually in a position of like A or C or D, something that's good for the guitar. And then I would find the key that I would actually sing it in and then put the capo on and learn it there. So it was usually a three-step process. And even just deciding the arrangements was interesting, because some of the songs had, I could find the original folios, the original sheet music, and I worked off of that. But then when you would listen to the most popular version of the song, say something that Mamie Smith sang, she often was not in the same key or singing the same lyrics, and the piano was playing a different set of chords, you know. So I took my arrangements in part from some of the original arrangements that were done for the sheet music, but then also filtered through the popular versions of the day. And there was one album that was very influential on the project, and that's that Louis Armstrong did an album of W.C. Handy songs, and I think it came out in the early 50s, and it's a really cool album. But and that's definitely a jazz album. But his tempos and everything he did was quite different than the originals. So I listened to that stuff as well. You can still hear the original recordings of this stuff if you go onto YouTube. You look it up, and there are people who have videoed themselves placing the needle of a Victrola down onto a 78. And so you're watching a video of a 78.
I bet some of the originals might also be available in some of the Internet Archives or Dusta Digital or some of those other projects.
Some of it may be. You'd be surprised how hard it was in certain cases to find out who owned these original copyrights and things. I ended up having to pay nobody because all the songs are over 100 years old, and they've all gone into the public domain at this point.
Well, having taught a course in intellectual property in my previous life, I know how boring that can be for regular listeners. So let's switch back, John Shane, here and talk about this music, the arranging the music of W.C. Handy for guitar. If people want to see what you've done or learn how to do it or learn how to play some of the stuff, what suggestion do you have?
Well, I am now coming out with a book. It's being published by Mel Bay, and it's all of these arrangements that are on the album. I think that this thing is going to be available online this month. The book will be available not only on Mel Bay's website, but on Amazon and whatever. And then I'll be selling it through my website, too.
Well, I'm glad you raised your website, John. If people want to learn more about you and all the different music that you play with FJ Ventura and a bunch of the other crazy people you play with, how can they learn more about you?
Just go to johnshane.com, and that is spelled J-O-N-S-H-A-I-N.
Do you find that kids enjoy this kind of music?
I think that actually it appeals quite a lot to everybody because it's very toe-tapping stuff. Very, you know, you look at the titles of the songs on the album. Almost every one of them have the word blues in it. The Memphis Blues, the St. Louis Blues, the Beale Street Blues. But really, when people think about blues, they often think about sad songs. And Handy took a lot of these older songs and pepped them up, put really interesting ragtime-style changes to them. And there, very many of them are quite fun. There's maybe a couple slow ones in that record, but most of them are upbeat toe-tappers and pretty entertaining. The folks back then didn't mess around with the lyrics. They were very clever.
Well, John, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and let's let the folks hear one more from your album.
Yeah, I think we're going to listen to the Beale Street Blues.
All right, here comes John Shane playing W.C. Handy's Beale Street Blues. Thanks again, John.
Yeah, thank you so much, Richard. It's been a great time. ¶¶
lights of gay Broadway. Old Market Street by the Frisco Bay. I've strolled the Prado, I've gambled on the Bourse. The seven wonders of the world I've seen. All the places I have been. Take my advice, folks, see Beale Street first. You'll see pretty ladies and beautiful gals. You'll see tailor-mades and hand-me-downs. You'll meet honest men and pickpocket skilled. You'll find business never closes till someone gets killed. If Beale Street could talk, if Beale Street could talk, married men would have to take their beds and walk, except one or two who never drink booze, and the blind man on the corner with the Beale Street blues. I know I'd rather be here than any place I know. It's gonna take the sergeant for to make me go. I'm going to the river. Here's a reason why. I'm going to the river, and here's a reason why. Because the river's wet and Beale Street's gone dry.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with John Shane that originally aired on WRCT's Whiskey Before Breakfast on July 27th of 2022. We're going to fill out the half hour here with some original music by W.C. Handy. First up, we'll hear W.C. Handy singing Loveless Love, which he wrote in 1921, and in 1926, he reworked it into the jazz standard that everybody knows, Careless Love. But this is his original song, Loveless Love. This was recorded back in 1939. W.C. Handy singing Loveless Love. And after that, you'll hear from W.C. Handy on the cornet, doing his most famous song, on the Ed Sullivan Show back on December 18th of 1949. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Love is like a gold brick in a bunco game. It's like a banknote with a bogus name. Both have caused me to downfalls. Love has done the same. Love has like its emblem, Cupid with his bow. Loveless love has bags and bags of dough. So carry it into Jack and pick 'em as you go. Love, oh love, oh loveless love, I set our hearts on goalless gold. From milkless milk and silkless silk, we are growing used to soulless soul. Such grafting times we never saw. That's why we have a pure food law. In everything we find a flaw. Even love, oh love, oh loveless love. Mm-hmm.
Louis North. With dreamless dreams and schemeless schemes, how we read our love boats on the shore. We S.O.S. by Wallace Wild. And in the wreckage of desire, we sigh for wings like Noah's dove, just to fly away from loveless love.
A great genius arose originally from Alabama and then switched to Memphis, Tennessee. W.C. Handy wrote St. Louis Blues. So let's have a great hand for Mr. Handy, won't you please?
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, pa@wrct.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Thank you.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Hi, this is Kevin, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. And welcome to another edition of In Black America and Ebony Spectrum.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Yeah, I did go to culinary school. After I finished business school at MSU, I quickly realized that the office life was not going to be for me. And I wanted to, you know, actually my father was like, you know, you've always loved cooking. Why don't you try culinary school? And so I went to Le Cordon Bleu in Atlanta for a few reasons. A, I was ready to miss some winters. I wanted to be somewhere warm. And I mean, at the time and now, I mean, Atlanta was just, you know, this epitome of Black excellence and entrepreneurship. And especially, you know, being in the North and, you know, being very much the minority, I wanted to go somewhere where, you know, where Black people were thriving. And, you know, they were they owned the malls. And just immerse myself and, you know, in my culture and really learn a lot more about the food that I love.
Justin Sutherland, Food Network Iron Chef winner, TV host, restaurateur, and author of Northern Soul, Southern-inspired home cooking from a Northern kitchen, published by Harvard Common Press. As a child growing up in Apple Valley, Minnesota, Sutherland spent a lot of time in the kitchen with his Japanese, Norwegian, and Southern grandparents. Food was their love language. They were both extremely different and made very good food. Family dinners and get-togethers were very important. All sides of the family came together for holidays and Sunday dinners. Before becoming a top-notch chef, Sutherland sold mortgages. That's when he realized there had to be a different way to make a living. Today, he's a nationally recognized celebrity cooking chef who is the co-host of the nationally syndicated Fast Foodies on True TV and a producer and host of Taste the Culture on TBS and TNT. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Northern Soul, Southern-inspired cooking from a Northern kitchen with Chef Justin Sutherland, In Black America.
You know, I've been cooking for, you know, 20-plus years, and I've been a restaurant owner for seven. And, you know, the food at Handsome Hog, you know, my first restaurant is really the food that speaks to me. It's recipes, you know, from my grandmother coming up, from my experiences being in the South and in Georgia and in Mississippi. And, you know, everybody just has really fallen in love with that food. And they've always been asking me, can I get this recipe? Can I get this recipe? And, you know, finally, it was time to put my memoirs together and share my recipes with the world.
African-American chefs and cooks have left their mark on American cuisine. They have pushed their way past the Eurocentric tradition that many absorb in culinary school. They are reflecting Africa and its diaspora in their kitchens. While the name of many key African-American culinary figures of early time has sadly been lost to history, their legacy persists to the present day, and the contemporary food scene in this country is rich with chefs of color who, thankfully, are being recognized and praised through their representation in leadership positions in professional restaurant kitchens is still far from where it should be. One chef who has made a name for himself is Justin Sutherland. He's the Food Network's winner of the Iron Chef America, host of True TV's Fast Foodies, owner of Southern restaurant Handsome Hog in St. Paul, Minnesota, and author of his first cookbook, Northern Soul, Southern-inspired home cooking from a Northern kitchen. Recently, In Black America spoke with Sutherland.
Born and raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Stayed around here, went to Minnesota State University after high school, then moved down to Atlanta for culinary school, spent a good amount of time in Atlanta, and then decided it was time to come back home and start getting into restaurants.
All right, any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I'm the oldest of seven. So I've got a whole basketball team.
So growing up was never dull.
It was never dull, and especially being the oldest. I mean, it was, yeah, I had to play all the roles.
I understand. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about George Floyd in Minneapolis, St. Paul. How did you all navigate that space, and how is the city healing now?
It was an impactful moment for the country, for the world, and especially for us here at home. Obviously, you know, the murder of George Floyd was devastating to the community, and then, you know, the community reacted. But, you know, it was really, for me personally, it was an opportunity, you know, especially being a Black business owner. You know, sometimes we have to worry, think about the business end first and kind of tiptoe around, you know, and how we put ourselves out there, because we gotta, you know, we gotta be welcoming to everybody and everything that to come into our restaurants. And for me, it was a great moment to kind of draw a line in the sand and really, you know, pick a side and stand up, you know, for my beliefs, you know, our people and the injustices that, you know, that have been happening forever. So, you know, it was good. I mean, I was out there marching on day one. I spoke on the steps of the state capitol. You know, even, you know, the day after we had our, you know, the big riots and, you know, our city was on fire, I took my food truck down, you know, and fed everybody who was helping with the cleanup efforts for free, and just, you know, making sure we had the opportunity to help our city heal. You know, we're coming back, and I think we'll come back stronger. But that was quite a moment in history.
Yeah, I understand. I found your introduction to be enlightening and illuminating. Talk to us about, you say food is the universal language.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody has to eat, you know, and all cultures have, you know, have their own food that they call their own. But, you know, I've always said no one's mad at a barbecue, and, you know, and some of the greatest, you know, conversations and accomplishments happen, you know, while sitting over a good meal. So it's just, you know, it's the ultimate unifier.
Talk to us about age five. You got everybody else want Tonka toys, but you got a honey bake, not a honey bake, but an easy bake oven.
Yeah, I don't think I was 5 years old, and, you know, I was always following my grandmother's in around in the kitchen. I saw that commercial for the easy bake oven, and mm-hmm. that's what I asked for Christmas. And, you know, at the time, you know, this is 25 years ago, and, you know, my dad's like, I'm not getting my son an easy bake oven, you know, but. You know, but grandma came through, and it was under the tree on Christmas, and that's when it all started.
Talk to us about your family and how that nurtured you into becoming a chef.
You know, dude, I do have a very, you know, multicultural background. I've got a grandmother from Japan who, you know, came over to this country during the Korean War. You know, and the other half of my family, grandfather from Mississippi, you know, family, they're sharecroppers down there, and then migrated up north. So, you know, soul food was a real big, you know, big part of that side of my family. So just being able to eat and so globally as a young child, it really, you know, impacted me and showed me, you know, the power that, you know, the power that sharing a meal can have, and the importance of, you know, diversifying your palate and your knowledge of the world.
Did you attend culinary school, or you were just matriculated in the kitchen and learn the craft, that you say, hands-on?
No, I did go to culinary school. After I finished business school at MSU, I quickly realized that the office life was not going to be for me. And I wanted to, you know, actually my father was like, you know, you've always loved cooking. Why don't you try culinary school? And so I went to Le Cordon Bleu in Atlanta, and for a few reasons. A, I was ready to miss some winters. I wanted to be somewhere warm. And I mean, at the time and now, I mean, Atlanta was just, you know, this epitome of Black excellence and entrepreneurship. And especially, you know, being in the North and, you know, being very much the minority, I wanted to go somewhere where, you know, where Black people were thriving, and, you know, they were the, you know, they owned the malls. They were not, you know, they, and just immerse myself and, you know, in my culture and really learn a lot more about the food that I loved.
It's amazing you said that. My daughter attended that same culinary school in Atlanta to to do pastries and whatever else she does currently now. So once you left culinary school, you obviously you came back to the Twin Cities, or did you go someplace prior to going back home?
Nope, I spent just about 5 years in Atlanta and then came back to the Twin Cities.
Okay, and once you arrived back in the Twin Cities, did you open up a restaurant or a food truck?
Not right away. You know, this was, I moved back and, you know, there were a couple, you know, very high-end restaurants that I wanted to work in, you know, so I bounced around and worked at a lot of places until I opened my first restaurant about 7 years ago.
So once you worked at those high-end restaurants, what are some of the things that you learned from them that you have taken to your particular establishments?
You learn what you want to be, and at the same time, you learn what you don't want to be. I think, you know, I learned, you know, a lot of discipline. I learned some amazing techniques, you know, from different chefs, different cuisines, you know, and I also experienced, you know, things and saw things in those kitchens that I knew, you know, when I owned my own place, you know, I didn't want to be that way. I wanted to be, make sure I was inclusive, make sure we had, you know, diverse staffs, make sure we were, you know, celebrating, you know, everybody. So, you know, it was good on both sides. You learned a lot of what to do and a lot of what not to do.
Talk to us about competing in the Iron Chef America competition.
I mean, that was wild. It was after, you know, the first year that I opened my restaurant. After the first year I opened my first restaurant, Handsome Hog, and I was sitting in my office and my cell phone rang. And they said, you know, I'm a producer from Food Network. We've been, you know, watching your career, and we'd love for you to be on Iron Chef. And I thought it was one of my friends prank calling me. I hung up on him. I said, I'm too busy for this. I hung the phone up. You know, they called right back, and they're like, no, Mr. Sutherland, we're serious. And I was like, wow. I mean, I grew up watching Iron Chef, especially the original old Japanese version with my grandma. And I, of course you say yes. It's not, you wouldn't say no to that. I didn't go into it with any thoughts of winning. I was just like, I want to be in this kitchen stadium. And, you know, we did our thing and ended up winning. And it was pretty crazy.
What were some of the things that you prepared during the competition?
So the secret is always one secret ingredient that you have to make five dishes out of. And our secret ingredient was lamb. So I wanted to take lamb I want to take them on a global journey of lamb. So I did, we did a Caribbean jerk lamb. I did a lamb curry. We did a lamb ramen. We did lamb African samosas and just really wanted to just show a global, you know, a dining experience using this ingredient. And, you know, the judges loved it.
Now talk to us about, you're on True TV, Fast Foodies.
Yeah, I've got two shows on True TV, and they're on HBO Max as well, Fast Foodies and Taste the Culture. Fast Foodies was great. It was, you know, I've done the Top Chef, Iron Chef, Chopped, all the competitions, and this was the first time, you know, we got to be the host of the show, and it was, you know, it's just a fun show. I mean, we have celebrities come in and bring their favorite fast food item or guilty pleasure, and then me and Kristen Kish and Jeremy Ford had the opportunity to first try and recreate that dish exactly. Like, can you make a cheesy gordita crunch exactly like Taco Bell makes it, and trying to dissect how they do it. And then the second round, you know, we take the idea of that dish and turn it into our own thing. Like, how would you put this on your menu? How would you turn it into a fine dining dish? So, you know, it's part comedy, part cooking, and just, it's a real fun show.
How did you navigate that pandemic with your restaurant, Handsome Hogs?
You know, it was difficult. You know, at the time, at pre-pandemic, I was operating 9 restaurants, actually. Handsome Hog being my first one and kind of my namesake. But, you know, we closed about 5 of them down. You know, Handsome Hog, we've since reopened a few. You know, Handsome Hog, we switched to just a takeout model only because we had no indoor dining for a while. And then, you know, we went to outdoor dining only, and luckily we have a pretty large 100-seat patio. You know, the community really came together and helped support us, and people still kept coming out to eat. But it was a tough time.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Justin Sutherland, Top Chef finalist, Iron Chef winner, restaurant group owner, TV cooking star, and author of Northern Soul, Southern-inspired home cooking from a northern kitchen. Mr. Southern, how did you get to the point that you needed to write a cookbook?
You know, I've been cooking for, 20 plus years, and I've been a restaurant owner for seven. And, the food at Handsome Hog, my first restaurant, is really the food that speaks to me. It's recipes, from my grandmother coming up, from my experiences being in the South and in Georgia and in Mississippi. And, everybody just has really fallen in love with that food. And they've always been asking me, can I get this recipe? And, finally it was time to put my memoirs together and share my recipes with the world.
How long did it take you to assemble?
It was about 2.5 years. It's a long, long process. You think you have, I've got thousands of recipes, written down. You're like, I got all these recipes. It's easy. We're just going to put them in a book. But no, from, the writing and the photography and breaking the recipes down to, for a home cook and just really being very intentional about, I didn't just want it to be, a book of recipes. All of these recipes are special to me and at meetings. I really wanted to, include a story around with it. So it was quite the process.
Well, let's go through some of that's in the book. We start out at the beginning, of course, which is a good place to start. Spices, sauces, and rubs. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think those are, that's kind of the foundation of cooking, is properly seasoning your food. And I've come up with, some staple spices. I actually have my own spice line out there that you can buy, everything from brisket rubs, rib rubs, fried chicken dredge, Tennessee hot seasoning. I've got a proprietary bourbon and smoke seasoning that we put on our wings, and just basic techniques for the home cook to properly season food and why that's important.
Now, when you're in the process of coming up with a meal, obviously there's trial and error. So how much error before you get it to the point where you like it and hopefully the customers will like it?
A lot lot of error. I mean, the amount of things that have been tried that people will never taste, people will be blown away by it. And that's why when people always say, I can't cook. It's not that you can't cook. You just got to keep trying. And if you don't like something, remember what you did wrong, try something different until it's right. So there's, most things never come out perfectly the first time. It's a lot of trial.
Let's talk about pickled things. Obviously, a lot of people can't pickle. So why was this included in the cookbook?
It was something that's very, very important in Southern culture. It's just a way to preserve food. And, we have short growing seasons in different regions around the country, everything from strawberries to peaches to apples, things that are in season for a short amount of time. And it's just a perfect way to, be able to preserve that, transform it into something different and be able to enjoy these foods year round.
I found it interesting because most people, when they have a meal, it's usually the main course, but you have appetizers as part of this cookbook. Why was that important to include?
Because I look at meals and there's different stages of eating. Sometimes you're just sitting down to have a plate, if you're throwing a dinner party or you're just, having people over, it doesn't always need to be a full meal. So, being able to execute, great, just snacks, is very important.
Also talk about, and I am a sides person. So when I saw this particular edition of the cookbook, I just say, hooray. Talk to us about sides and why that's important to actually complement whatever the main course is.
I'm with you. I'm a sides guy. I mean, we get into Thanksgiving, I forget the turkey, forget all that. I'm looking for some greens, some mashed potatoes, some sweet potatoes, all that stuff. So, I think people get very focused on the protein or what that main dish is. But, sides can be a meal in themselves. And, a lot of those dishes, especially, for me, the most important dish in that book to me is the greens. I think greens tell the story of soul food and, the migration of enslaved people from West Africa and in the way that our people took these simple, humble ingredients that, you know, were thrown away or just thought very little of. And, you know, we take these things and turn them into something great.
It seems to me that you made an assertive effort in the book to include foods that are, one, tasty, but also nutritious. Why was that important?
Absolutely. I mean, food and nutrition, you know, go hand in hand. You know, obviously we all need to eat. We all like to eat. But there's, you know, there's ways to get all the flavors and all of the things you desire out of a meal. But, you know, but still being healthy. I mean, we gotta take care of our bodies. We only get one.
Also interesting was the sandwich section. Obviously, people are on the go. You know, they move to and fro. And sometimes they can't eat a balanced meal as far as three or four courses. Why the sandwich section?
Yeah, I love sandwiches. I mean, I'm always on the go. You know, it's whether it's, you know, driving here or there at the airport or flying all over and just being able to, you know, get everything you need, you know, in one bite. I think the construction of a sandwich is very important to make sure you're hitting all of those flavor components, texture components, and getting all the nutrients that you need. And, you know, in a lot of our staple sandwiches, like, you know, the po' boy or the hot brown or Tennessee hot fried chicken, I mean, those things are phenomenal, and I think it's just important to share that.
The other thing I found interesting is that each section, while you describing what that section is, but it's also a narrative. Why was that important for you to have some type of say about that particular section and why it was near and dear to you?
I think the why is very important. You know, I think intention in everything that we do is very important. And a lot of these, you know, these foods either have a story from, you know, from my family and my history, or, you know, can resonate with somebody else, or just, you know, explaining why these things are important, where they came from and why they're important to me. And, you know, just that's why I really wanted to be, you know, a book as well as only recipes.
As a person that's putting their particular style and of culinary art out there, why is it important for people of color such as yourself to be included in this culinary world in which we're living in?
You know, it's, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, soul food, you know, black culture, that is American culture. I mean, we're a people that built this country. And, you know, you have very humble French food, you have very humble Italian food, and all of these things have been allowed to be elevated to these fine dining levels. And, but, you know, our food of our people has always been seen as less than or, you know, not up to, you know, a James Beard or Michelin star or fine dining level. And it's so important that's included, because that's the story of America.
Having cooked all these items that's in the cookbook, what is your special? What do you enjoy most preparing?
Oh, you know, like I said, I mean, barbecue is a big thing for me. You know, the ribs and brisket and just that process of slow cooking, I love. Sides, like we talked about, are hugely important. I mean, you know, making, you know, mac and cheese and collard greens and the cream corn and stuff like that, I mean, I absolutely love. And then I really love the, you know, Cajun food. I've got a lobster etouffee on there and a gumbo and just these, you know, Cajun style cuisine that I really, really love.
As I look at the title again, as I'm speaking to you, I'm, you know, looking at the book, Northern Kitchen versus Southern Soul, the difference in the style of cooking. You've been up north in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but you also cooked down in Atlanta. The different regions of the type of, and you mentioned Creole, the different regions as far as their food specialties.
Yeah, I think, you know what I wanted to, you know, people to know is that it's, you know, there's so many different regions of Southern cooking. You know, there's Northern cooking, and I'm not, you know, claiming to, you know, to represent these regions exactly. I'm taking, you know, my love of Southern cuisine and putting, you know, the spin on it, you know, from, you know, some of the traditions of the North.
What has been the response thus far from those who had an opportunity to see the book?
It's been fantastic. I mean, I'm very, very blessed. It's done better than I could have hoped for. And I'm just glad people are enjoying it, the recipes as well as the stories. But it's been very, very successful. And makes you very, when you pour your heart into something and put all of your recipes and your stories on paper, and it seems like this thing that's never going to happen, and the first time you get that hard copy in your hand and realize it's out there for the world, it's a pretty cool feeling.
So was it difficult for a publisher to buy into your vision?
No, the publisher called me. I wasn't even, it was right at the beginning of the, COVID pandemic. Restaurants were getting, shut down, and the publisher called me and said, we think your food would be perfect for a cookbook. This is what the market's looking for. Well, would you like to write one?
Also, obviously, you say go yes. Ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I just said, obviously, it's not something you say no to.
I also understand that you have a whiskey that you come up with.
I do. I love bourbon. I love whiskey. Handsome Hog, we pride ourselves in having the largest bourbon collection in Minnesota. And there's an amazing local distillery called Tattersall. And they, again, approached me. They said, we know you love whiskey and bourbon. How would you like to make your own? And I was like, absolutely. So I, got together with their master distiller, learned the process. We distilled three individual single malts, a chocolate malt, mesquite and an apple. We aged them individually in barrels for 2 years. And then after they were ready, then we started the blending process where we were taking a little bit of each and mixing them together to try and get that perfect blend that I wanted to put out there that I thought would go with my food.
At the time of this conversation, we're a week away from Thanksgiving. Are you doing a traditional Thanksgiving, or are there other things you're going to throw in the mix?
I will say we do.